And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls with the professor, John Gastel. His work is called Gray Matters, so get ready to make the call when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. We're with the professor, John Gastel. His book, Gray Matters. He has another book called Hope for Democracy, How Citizens Can Bring Reason Back into Politics. John, what was that aha moment for you when you decided to write Gray Matters? What did you see? What did you feel that decided to write it, and especially in novel form?
You know, I worried that people would trade their own independent judgment away too quickly for the security of kind of comfort and predictability in their life. You know, we talk about big data, and you talk about it on your show. I mean, the story about Twitter and hacking accounts and so on is partly about how much we can find out about people, right? Well, I could use the internet or the loop in Gray Matters to find out a lot about you and try to kind of replicate you in a sense, so that tomorrow you're the same guy you were yesterday and the same the day before. And, you know, in Gray Matters, that's tempting because dementia threatens to take that away from you. But, you know, I worry that people might say, well, you know, that's just not a bad policy in general. But then what happened to independent judgment? How come George can't change his mind all of a sudden now, right? Mm-hmm. You keep saying the same thing. Well, you need to be able to change your mind. And so in a way, Gray Matters is a novel that explores the importance of independent judgment, of looking at the facts and thinking for yourself and potentially admitting you're wrong and changing your mind.
What happens when technology goes awry and something goes drastically wrong?
Well, all kinds of different things can happen. In Gray Matters, what can happen is that we can kind of turn people into glitches, right? I mean, it would be one thing if my technology made you even more predictable and made you, you know, kind of the same sort of person as yesterday and you started to become boring. But all it has to do is have a bad hiccup, and all of a sudden, now you're careening off in some other direction. Maybe you're acting on an impulse you never did. Maybe you proposed to your wife's sister or something. The technology could guide you in ways that you would not have guided yourself if you were exercising independent judgment. So that's really part of what Gray Matters is about, is holding on to that wonderful, mysterious power in our brain to think, reflect, and make judgments. And again, worrying about how easily people might give that up to make their lives a little simpler.
Are we being manipulated by experts, John?
When we let ourselves be, yes. We need experts, right? I mean, again, the top of your show was about expertise, right? In astronomy, economics, sociology, and so on. You're University of the Air there, right?
That's right.
We need that. We got to know the hard numbers. But what we do with those numbers is up to us, and we do need to exercise independent judgment. You know, George, I don't know if you know, but scientists actually do worry about this problem of science communication. And for some scientists, it is a simplistic idea. How do I get people to understand the wonderful things I know, right? That's not what we're really shooting for. The better science communication scholars worry about how do we keep the public and the scientific community in dialogue with each other. So if we're developing the ability to edit genes, we need to hear from the public, right? We need the public to weigh in on this. It's not just a technology question. In fact, colleagues of mine in Australia have created an international group of scholars and practitioners out there in the world who are trying to have kind of a global conversation on that very issue to get people from all walks of life to start asking themselves, what do we want to do with gene editing technology? It's here, folks. So the question is, how do we manage it, right? What are things that we think are okay, and what are things that we think are not okay? If you don't have that dialogue happening, you have science and technology just running off by itself, and you have the public running off in God knows what direction, and the two might have a catastrophic collision if they can't get together and let the public and the science kind of inform each other.
But see, the brainiacs might say, the public doesn't understand this. They don't know. We're going to make up their minds. We're going to make the decisions for them because we're in the know. And that's what they do to us.
Well, that really can happen. But fortunately, we do live in the democracy you alluded to earlier in your show. And there can be some real interesting interventions. Now, you mentioned the nonfiction book I had come out earlier this year, Hope for Democracy. I sneak the core idea in that into Gray Matters, and that is this, George. For any of your listeners who live in the state of Oregon, they probably know about something called the Citizens Initiative Review, where a small random sample of people from the state, a couple dozen people, get a chance to meet for a full week and study a ballot measure. You know how in Oregon, like in so many states, they actually vote on laws sometimes. Well, this small group of people gets to meet with experts. There's the experts, the brainiacs, right? They get to meet with people who are for and against a proposed law and write a one-page analysis in simple English. It goes into the official voter's guide in Oregon, and every voter can read that and make up their own mind. Now they understand what they're voting on. So my point is that, yeah, sure, there's, brainiacs who might study that policy question for 20 years, and they know a lot, but they're not the public and the people of Oregon. The people of Oregon, they don't have 20 years to study this issue, but they can read a statement written by their peers who had at least a week to study it. So there are creative little interventions like this. This is a law in the state of Oregon that can help us bridge that gap. You see what I mean? Between the brainiacs and the public.
Speaking of Oregon, we're going to Portland right now. Had is with us, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Had.
Hello, George and John. I'm a longtime listener. I've been listening since Art Bell days.
Thank you, Had. And are things calming down in Portland yet?
They are a little bit. The feds have left, and the local police, the state police, are handling now, and it's quite a peaceful scene.
Good.
The protests are continuing. But I am calling. I want to let you know that I use a cognitive prosthetic. I'm a survivor of traumatic brain injury, and I use a cognitive prosthetic called My Bionic Brain. It runs on my iPad. John, have you heard of cognitive prosthetics?
I have. Tell me a little bit about your experience with the iPad app.
Oh, God, it is fantastic. I thrive on this. It keeps track of my every activity in the day. It is actually... It was created by Kathy Moeller. She's a master's in linguistics, and it teaches. It's actually an existent system for a healthy brain.
How does it work, Ed? How does it work?
It's got to do items scheduled through the day. I've got projects listed and completion of the projects. Keeps track of my progress. I keep a journal, and it's a way to keep track of things that I will. Because I do have a brain injury, and I know that.
Can I ask your listener a question, George?
Absolutely, John.
I've got to ask, so I know you haven't read Gray Matters, but where would you draw the line? Let's say that your app on your iPad wanted to get more and more in the business of your life. Where would you kind of put out your hand and say, hold on there, that's my call?
I don't know how to answer your question. I'm sorry. I actually teach mindfulness meditation to enhance neuroplasticity. So I'm still working on getting the brain better on its own using the timeless practice of meditation. Like George has interviewed Dan Harris, who did with the 10% Happier app and that meditation technique. But it's very useful for individuals like me with brain injury.
And it feels to me like that meditation is a technology you have control over. You're the one practicing.
Yes.
You're the one learning it. It's an ancient tradition, right?
Absolutely.
That sounds great
it's
to me.
Yourself rehabilitation. I just put a website out today. Can I mention that? It's
goldmindmeditation.com.
It's a free meditation instruction.
Had, without the app, if you didn't have the app, how far back would that set you?
I would have a chaos of unrelated activities, and this keeps me on track for projects. It lets me know how well I'm doing with completing them. I've got a monitor. This works perfectly for me. I know this is not for everyone with brain injury, but I love it. It works for me, and I want people to know about it. My Bionic Brain.
And let me ask you this, Had, and jump in here, John, too, but if they get to the point where this app could be inserted into your brain with a little chip, would you have that done?
I don't think so.
Why not? Tell us why not. Why not put the chip in the brain? Why have to keep it outside of your body?
I would need to know more information. I don't. There's too much I don't know about that.
Sure.
Like everyone else, we don't know what we're talking about. because the brain is, you know, it's already the wonder of the universe that lives between our ears. And
well,
I'm frightened. I know the change of having no brain injury. I've had this now for 30 years, so I'm skilled at living with it. The meditation helps fantastically. I teach people with brain injury to do meditation also. And we've started a bakery here in Portland called Cerebellum's Bakery. We're a nonprofit, and we train people with brain injury to learn job skills.
Good for you. That's pretty remarkable. Had, thank you. Keep in touch with us, and good luck with everything that you do. Isn't that amazing, though, John?
I swear, George, I did not plant that call.
No. They're out there.
We didn't know each other, but you got to trust me on that. I did not see that coming.
Now, when these chips are inserted in the brains eventually, what do they attach them to?
Well, I go with just a simple little nano chip. I call it a fish scale because it just slides in under the skin. It should have gone through the FDA, but I have a sneaky little way around that in the book. But if you take Elon Musk's example with the Neuralink, basically think of it as threading into the brain. Once you can get into the, you know, kind of the neurological network in there, you know, you're hooked in. And so that's the basic idea, is to just get something to connect with the brain, like a, you know, like a battery touching the connector. That's what we're looking at.
How do they get it in there? Would they inject it with some kind of needle? Or would they, you know, have to slice your skull and put it in that way?
Probably closer to the first one, especially when we're dealing with nanotech. I mean, these things are so small that it really would almost just be like injecting it in into your body. But again, we're now squarely in the science fiction part where I have to consult with colleagues because this is not my expertise, and I just get far enough, and then I get back to the things I know about. And with your listener, I was really interested. Did you hear how forcefully he said, you know, I'm not so sure I want something in my
body? Yeah, I know, and I bet a lot of people would say that.
I think so, too. I absolutely do. And at the same time, look how quickly we give ourselves over, right, to the phone that now you see a kid or, frankly, a lot of adults, including myself, who can't let go of their phone, right? It's not even a phone anymore.
It's an appendage of our body.
You know, in gray matter, as in all science fiction, you have to deal with this problem of, okay, the world has changed, but it has to be familiar, right? And so in gray matters, I was thinking, I can't call things smartphones, because even if we're just 4 or 8 years ahead, we're not going to be calling them that. So I used the joke, some blogger said, you know what, they're all Zunes. All these technology, all these tablets, all these phones, we're just going to call them Zunes, which was the failed Microsoft music app. And I could see something like that happening, where we don't even know what a tablet or a phone is anymore. It's just the thing you have. It's on your ear, or it's in your pocket, or you plop it into your navel. Who knows? But that's how insidious technology is, right? It just gets into our life. We take it for granted. And it changes us in ways sometimes we didn't intend.
How far away are we from chips in the brain? 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? What do you think?
Well, we're already experimenting with these kinds of technologies. And think about the good they can do, right? It really, Neuralink is tapping into something that we're already working with, which is helping people operate, say, bionic limbs, right, if they're missing a limb, or potentially, you know, reactivating parts of their body that right now they're not able to control because of neurological problems. We're already there. I mean, it's not a mass market product, obviously, but, you know, these things come fast. And, George, I'm sure you've noticed the pace of technological change sometimes feels like it's accelerating dramatically.
Absolutely. Lynn in Vancouver, Canada. Hello, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi there, George and John. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call. I just love these kinds of books. So thanks, John, for writing this one, and I can hardly wait to get it. It's luscious, the topic, constant. Now, I have sort of a comment, a question, and then a question all rolled into something real quick, and then I'll take your comments off the air. So I was first thinking about the neurochips and the dystopian view, and I guess my first question is about thought crime, because, of course, I'm thinking of 1984, Minority Report, Videodrome, Stepford Wives, and, of course, Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent. And then, of course, the second question is, what future do those of us who don't want to be chipped have in a dystopian society? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Well, I have described to a friend, Gray Matters, they asked, what kind of a book it is? I said, it's like Minority Report, except the creepy people who anticipate your crimes are actually just kind of friendly and trying to help you still cause your life to go to pieces. And so I think this idea that, you know, thought crimes could be anticipated and so on, I mean, the Internet is doing that. Right? I mean, it is absolutely giving us information about crime. I mean, police departments can use modeling to try to anticipate where crimes are likely to happen that night. They don't know about a particular person, but they just know at this time of day the pattern is such, right, that this is where a crime is like, so we'll make sure to have an extra patrol car out there, right? It's just a question of how much data is being crunched, how hard, right, and what we're able to predict. Again, what Gray Matters says is, well, what if we reflect that back on ourselves and we try to predict our own behavior? Now, I think Lynn raises good questions and is concerned about this. Well, hey, coming from Vancouver, BC, right? Yeah, what a beautiful place, right? But just like our caller from Portland, she's plugged into technology but is also wary of it. That's what sci-fi helps us do, right? It helps us think about, okay, how could this go wrong? This seems like such a wonderful thing. How could it go wrong? Well, that's why I'm excited for callers like Lynn to be asking these questions, because they do worry, right? They're excited that, you know, their app on their kitchen table can play music, but they also wonder, yeah, but it's listening to me. What's going to happen next?
And, you know, when the vaccine, if and when the vaccine comes out for COVID-19, if they ever get it, I wonder how many people will line up to do that.
Probably an overwhelming number will line up to do that. I mean, but that's the problem with vaccines, and that's why they take so long, right? Is you'd better not release the vaccine unless it's ready to go.
That's right.
Video game companies, you know, update their games, and I have amazing new features. I'm a fan of some of these myself.
It's easy to update video games, but you can't once you've injected somebody. That's it.
Oh, yeah, but no, even when they update the video games, invariably the server crashes, right? I'm playing Red Dead, the, you know, Western-themed game, and it, of course, crashes. Well, big deal, right? So people like me, boo-hoo. But, yeah, you can't do that with a vaccine. You can't. And let's be clear, you know, vaccines have a safety tolerance, right? We need to make sure it's safe enough. Nothing is perfectly safe.
Well, and these companies that develop them are immune from prosecution and lawsuit.
Well, that's a legal decision. And now we're getting into, again, the relationship between technology and democracy, aren't we, right? So, yeah, that's a fair question about who develops the vaccine, you know, what the role of the government and public oversight is. And
well,
I want a lot of public oversight.
I do, too. And if they try to force mandatory vaccines, John, we're going to have a huge problem. Huge problem.
Well, it certainly looks like in the United States we would, because unfortunately the pandemic is politicized now. And that doesn't happen to most science issues. Most science we don't politicize, but sometimes it does get tangled up in politics, and then things get messy.
Not that it's appropriate to have a joke about COVID-19, but the story out there now is when it goes away, November 4th.
Yeah, I wouldn't anticipate that. I mean, the one thing I would say is COVID is such a global problem that, you know, the American election seems sort of related to it, but that's just because we're looking at ourselves. I mean, New Zealand and other countries are on completely different timescales, but are dealing with the exact same.
Everybody is. John, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment. The name of the book, Gray Matters. John's website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, Miss Ada joins us as we talk about hoodoo cleansing and protection magic. So get ready for that part of the Coast to Coast program. And we're going to come back in a moment with John Gestel and take final calls. His book is called Gray Matters. It's a novel, but it is strangely very real, too. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with John Gestel. His book is called Gray Matters. We'll get to your calls in just a second. John, the people in Gray Matters, the subject folks, how realistic are they?
I think they're pretty real. I think they represent engineers, right, who have a new technology that they're excited about, and they want to focus on just pushing it as far as they can for the excitement of discovery. You got the social scientists who want to advance knowledge, right, understand people better. not necessarily control them, but they kind of can't help themselves. And you've got the kind of visionary, right? The Mahatma Golden character who wants to have a big message that everybody believes and feel important. Those are, I think, very real types of people out there.
Joe, Long Island, New York, to get us started. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, John. I want to ask you about the book, and then I'll have a comment. With the book, you seem to talk about people that are dark and sinister, but believe they are not that, that they're helping people. I'd like to ask you to compare that with the dystopian novel 1984. Was that similar? And also how all the different larger groups coordinate or didn't coordinate in your novel, and maybe how they couldn't coordinate ultimately. And then also the idea of democracy. I don't see the United States as having anything to do with democracy. You know, nobody would vote for atomic bombs and the CIA the way it is. The average person doesn't have the slightest say in our government and the way things are run. It's profiteers and big factions. That's what I think.
Well, thank you, Joe, from Long Island. There's a lot going on here. Let's take them one at a time here. First, you're absolutely right that in Gray Matters, the villains think they're doing good. In 1984, it's written in a very different way, right? It's written from the point of view of Winston Smith, a character who is subject to everything they're doing, right? He's the victim. So we never really get to hear the story. I have a feeling it's pretty sinister. And, you know, the movie Brazil, I think, captures that spirit that, you know, maybe they're kind of blithe about it, but I don't think they think they're doing good. In Gray Matters, again, it's quite different. And I do find villains that believe in themselves a little more compelling. The other question Joe raised is, hey, are we really a democracy? Do people really even have the slightest say? So a couple things here. One, maybe Joe's going hardcore academic on me because in all fairness, the U.S. isn't a democracy. In fact, I like the word democracy to be kind of above any existing government. We can aspire to be more democratic, right? We can do things that make our country more or less democratic, right? The Voting Rights Act, the empowerment of women to vote, those are pro-democratic movements in our history. But we can also backslide and move further away. But as soon as we say we are a democracy, it kind of makes it sound like we've perfected things, and we'll never perfect things. So I'm with Joe as far as that goes, but I do see ways in which we do have influence over how we run our society. And all you have to do is look around at the different countries that have a legitimate claim to at least calling themselves something like a democracy, and they disagree with each other, right? Their societies choose some differences in how they organize their economy and their society, their schools and everything. And to that extent, you do see the expression of public will. But Joe's right. I mean, there are reasons to feel alienated and frustrated, and that's what my nonfiction is actually mostly about, is trying to find the ways that we can make our society more democratic and acknowledge the real problems that people like Joe are so frustrated by that they don't even want to use the word democracy anymore.
In Gray Matters, John, is there something that bothers you in terms of what's happening to society?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things that really bothers me about society is that people don't think there's anything more to political judgment than following your ideology. And I know a lot of your listeners, you know, like the examples of earlier callers you've had and some of the segments you had there, people are saying things like, I want to think deeper, right? I want to hear different points of view.
Yep.
The best. That's great. We need more of that. We need people who don't let their ideologies become kind of a prison that they can't escape from. And then they just turn to other people and say, well, what am I supposed to believe? This is a new thing. Nanotechnology is new. Am I for it or against it? That's not the way we want people thinking in a democracy. We want them to ask, what can I learn here? What are the trade-offs? What are the values at stake, right? And then start to make independent judgments. That's what worries me, is the lack of deliberation. So Gray Matters is trying to kind of warn us about that and maybe point helpfully in a couple directions for things that might help us.
Let's go out to Boulder, Colorado. Teresa's with us. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, George. How you been?
Okay. Hope you are, too.
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. Everything's so crazy now.
Oh, my. Yep.
But I wanted to, I was looking on YouTube. I do a lot of YouTube lately. And I came across a lecture by Bill Gates. And he was talking to people about viruses that he wants to put into vaccination that attacks the God center of the brain. They know where we can think about, where we think about God and where that all comes from. And that scared me, you know. I thought, that's great for Xi, you know. You can wipe out the Uyghurs and the Falun Gong and all of those people. And I think if they can do that, they will do that. And that's terrifying.
It is kind of scary. How long ago was that video, do you know?
You know, I think it was like early 2000s, like maybe 2004 or 5. Maybe it was 2006.
Yeah. A lot of people, John, are terrified of Bill Gates with his backing of these vaccines. And, you know, I would hope that he is just a well-intentioned, naive person. But I don't know. You hear anything about that?
Sure. Like I said, I used to live in Seattle. I taught at the University of Washington. And so invariably, you know, friends and colleagues would get connected with the Gates Foundation. In fact, an old college friend of mine worked for them. And I can say a couple positive things about the Gates Foundation. And if you look at things like malaria, river blindness, dengue fever, and so on, the Gates Foundation was partly concerned with attacking some of the most mundane but deadly diseases that say mundane in the sense that we all know about mosquitoes, right? We know about diarrhea and so on. But these things can actually be quite devastating. And so the Gates Foundation picked some good targets for things that, you know, they kind of wanted to find the next polio, right? And say, look what we can do. And, you know, maybe they haven't had that level of results. But they have had some really positive results. I can't say anything about the YouTube video. I don't know what that is. But I think it is fair to say that Gates absolutely wants to be kind of a renowned philanthropist who's made big interventions. And I know sometimes it feels that someone with that much concentrated wealth is sort of all-powerful, and I do worry about a society that has such extreme inequalities. But consider this. When I moved to Seattle, my mom gave me a little bit of money and said, hey, learn about the stock market. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to invest in Microsoft because 10 years from now, I don't want to say, oh, my God, why didn't I put money in Microsoft? Well,
Smart move. My money went
nowhere, of course, because all the geniuses in the world that own and run that company and own its stock, you know, they couldn't make gold out of hay, and so Microsoft just kind of trundled along. It's obviously a successful company, but my point is they don't control the world, but they have a heck of a lot of influence.
They sure do. Max is with us, first-time caller in the state of Washington. Hey, Max.
Hey, George, big fan, man. First time calling in. So I've got something for you guys here to comment on and everything. When all this mask stuff started a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago, it was a big heated conversation, but I started making one. I was like, if I'm going to wear one, this thing is going to work. And I was listening about the UVC light. So I've actually built one, kind of retrofitted it in with some painter's mask, like a half face one. I started looking in there and I actually put it online on my Facebook. Everybody wanted one. All my friends did. And I was like, all right, well, is this worth, like, looking at a patent on? Well, that started me down a rabbit hole. When they go make vaccines, they take UVC light to deactivate the viruses, right? And normally they'll do it within a fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can basically save the corpses of the vaccines for genetic material to get your immune system to start kicking. Well, by doing this, just by neutralizing it in the air that you're breathing in, it's a respiratory disease, right? So you are doing that as you're breathing this in if you come into contact with the virus in your breath. So it's basically a vaccine in a mask. I was just like dumbfounded, just like, whoa. I mean, but I figured I have to share this stuff with the world here because, I mean, that's just petty and everything to not be putting this stuff out there. I did talk to Jimmy Church about it the other day, but he was on a, it was just like right at the end of his show, but I've been wanting to call in the Coast to Coast. So curious as to if you have any questions about that or whatever. I definitely want to share everything I've learned so far about it.
Well, that's great technology. And the fact that you thought of it after hearing about the UVs, that's pretty dramatic stuff. John, that's technology at its best.
Well, it's sort of shade tree mechanic, right? People, you know, take what they know, learn a bit more, fiddle around, try something out. And in gray matters, we see something like that. What happens when it's done at a small scale like that, and you invent something new, but you have the resources to push it out as a product, you can get way ahead of the headlights. That is, you don't really know what it's going to do. You don't really know what the long-term, you haven't run randomized controlled trials and so on. And so, you know, tinkering is great, and it is how we invent a lot of things, but we have to think about when the tinkering is done by people with tremendous resources, and they can kind of get something out there that they haven't really thought through the consequences of. It can be dangerous. Again, that's sci-fi, right? Making us look at things that don't quite exist yet to make us think about whether we really want them.
He should be on Shark Tank. What do you think?
I don't know. Those sharks are pretty hungry.
John, we only got a couple minutes left, and I want you to talk about the book again, where people can get it. Then we'll take final phone calls. Gray Matters, available at bookstores, Amazon, I guess off your website?
You name it. Yeah, go to johngastel.com. You'll see both Gray Matters, Hope for Democracy we talked about, and then another novel coming out later this year, Dungeon Party, which is about the world of these role-playing gamers, these D&D folks and so on.
I saw that. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that can be a powerful experience that really changes people's lives. And so I write about that from the point of view of the players. So it's exciting. It's a exciting year for me. A lot's come out this year. It's a little overwhelming, but let me just say, George, it's such a pleasure being on your show. I see why this show is so successful. My friends have been excited, you know, commenting on what a great conversationalist you are. So really, as a Penn State professor, it's been an honor sharing the air with you and debating a little bit and also sharing some ideas back and forth. Thank you so much.
And let's take some final calls and wrap things up. Mayat in New York. Mayat, you're on with John. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Excellent, excellent program. A point of clarification and a broad question that I'll listen over the air.
All right.
First of all, John, I love your work. What do you teach at Penn State? And for those listeners who are writers or aspiring writers, give us some encapsulation of your process. Like to hear about whether you use an agent and something about your publisher so that those who want to review your book would have some know where to go. And I listen over the air. Hope you got my questions.
Well, if he didn't, I did for him.
I'm good, George. Here we go. So the number one thing I teach my students in classes is deliberation. I want them to be critical thinkers. I want them to be good listeners. I want them to really be able to express themselves and listen to what other people experience. And I want them to use facts, right? Reflect on your values, but think about facts and try to make informed, reflective judgments. That's the number one thing I'm trying to teach. As for writing, I am a believer in, I'll use a more polite word, the terrible first draft. You just got to write. And that's I believe in that process. That's why it took me years to finish these manuscripts, is I started with an idea, and then I wanted to keep refining it. And to refine it, it's kind of like deliberation. You need to share it with people. So don't be shy about your work. Welcome feedback, and try to take that to heart. I've had some wonderful people, informal and formal editors over the year, really help me crystallize the ideas in these books and refine them. And then, you know, finding a publisher is a challenge, but I decided that I didn't want to self-publish. I wanted to have the discipline of a publisher deciding to publish these books, and that's John Hunt Publishing, is a cool, independent sci-fi, fantasy, and other genre publisher in England, and they were excited about the book, so here we are.
Well, good for you. They call themselves Cosmic Egg Books, too, don't they?
Cosmic Egg, yeah, is an imprint of John Hunt. They do a whole bunch of different books. In fact, they have whole genres of books that I think your listeners would be really into that are way outside my my sort of reading list. But the sci-fi fantasy imprint Cosmic Egg, you're absolutely right, picked up this book and Dungeon Party as well. So, again, but that's my big encouragement for writers is you gotta take the time to just write, and then you gotta share your work and get feedback and listen.
And the audiobook comes out in a few weeks, right?
Yeah, it's already done. It's recorded, it should be coming out as soon as Audible says it passes the sound check. And again, the voice of Gray Matters is actually the voice, Victor Bavine, of the Mueller Report. So some people will even recognize the voice.
I love it. John, keep in touch. Let us know when Dungeons is out. We'll get you back on, okay?
You got it. I'll see you then.
You got it. Up next, we're talking hoodoo on Coast to Coast.